Well, good morning and welcome to Bethel Church. I was going to say that we have lifeboats that will be coming to the front door at the end so that you can be taken to your car if it has not floated away. And crazy weather. Also, just to say that this is the end of reading week. A lot of students are coming back on this weekend. And just to say this, we always want to be aware of the various demographics that are at Bethel, different people, different stages and ages. And so this is a good season just to make sure you notice the students, make sure you're praying for them, reaching out to them, because this is a hard chapter. The last lap to get them through to April exams and all that and the stress. And I'm not trying to build anxiety if you are a student here this morning for you. But it's a reality, right? So as a church, we just want to be aware of that as they return. They're coming into the city today. Some have returned, but school starts tomorrow, so have fun. So we are starting a series, as you see, now you see me, now you don't, a series in Esther. And I think it was mentioned earlier that video that you saw is on Right Now Media, which you have access to, and you can go and watch that whole thing as it gives a kind of an overview of the book of Esther. And as we've been preparing for this series, and it's just a three-week series, it was a four-week series, and there was a snowstorm back in January, and that kind of changes everything, because Easter is set, we can't move Easter, so we have to kind of make some adjustments, so we're doing a three-week series in Esther. But as you think about this book, and you think about the theme, and you think about the focus of it, one of the questions that kept coming up to me as I was thinking about this was, you know, what does power look like? What does authority look like? What does it look like for someone to be in charge and to perhaps determine the outcomes, or someone who can flex their muscle and really shape something that is happening? What does power look like? As I thought of that, I thought, well, you know, power can look like a number of things. It can look like the score in a hockey game, like 6-3. In case you watch hockey, or it can look like the score, and you say, well, the most powerful team, the one with the greatest skill, won, right? Or it can look in political world, it looks like the party that got the most votes, or in business, perhaps stock value illustrates the power, or sometimes it's the loudest person in the room is seen as a powerful person, or advertisements. A couple of weeks ago, Anna Robbins spoke, and if you may remember her, in fact, I think this may have been something she did with our leadership at night, but she talked about the influence of culture, that various media organizations can shape the things you buy, and the colors that you choose to dress in, and all of that, and they have tremendous power. And she talked about how commercials pop up on our screen, unbeknownst to us, we're hardly even aware of it, but there it is, and they have incredible power, incredible influence. What does power look like? All kinds of faces. But here's a question. Sometimes I think, or here's a statement, sometimes power doesn't look like what we think it will look like. Sometimes power has a surprising face, like this next slide. This lady, you may know her. She won the Nobel Peace Prize 2014. I think she was 17 years old, youngest ever to win the Nobel Peace Prize. She's from Pakistan. The former prime minister says she's the most prominent citizen in Pakistan. She advocated for women's rights, children's rights, for education. And as she was traveling on a bus back from school one day, there was an assassination attempt on her life. She lived. And her cause now has become an international movement. That's not the face of power, is it, really? Sometimes power doesn't look like, doesn't have the face that we think it might have. And sometimes it doesn't show up in the places that we might normally think power to be. In fact, James wanted his audience, his diaspora of Jews, to understand that there's power, and power is not in the normal places that you might think it is. Power can be in small little places like your mouth. Like your tongue, right? And you remember what James says? He's reminding his audience of how power and influence can show up in small little places. And he says, the tongue is a small member. It boasts of great things. How great a forest is set ablaze by such a small fire. And the tongue is a fire, a world of unrighteousness. The tongue is set among our members, staining the whole body, setting on fire the entire course of life, and set on fire by hell. It's making a point here. In fact, some of us, all of us have done this before, but some of us might be trying to clean up a mess that we created this week by this tiny little thing called the tongue, because it delivered some words that were really, really nasty, and now we have to clean it up. See, I think when you think about power, influence, authority is sometimes found in surprising places and has surprising faces at times. It's not always what we would expect it to be. It doesn't always have the face that we think it should, or found in the place and expressed in that way, in the way that we think it should. And I think that's an important issue. This is an important topic because I don't know what your experience is like, but for those that are here this morning and you're a disciple, you're a follower of Christ, would you not say there are times where you think to yourself, well, man, if I were God, this is the face I would put on power, and this is the place I would demonstrate power, and this is how I would do it. But sometimes, as the series title says, now you see me, now you don't. And we sometimes wrestle with the faces and the places of power, where it shows up, how it's expressed, and we bring into question the creator of the universe and how perhaps he even runs his universe. Well, with that, we come to the book of Esther this morning. If you don't know where the book of Esther is, don't worry about it. Just go to the index and find the page number. It's not a book that you probably regularly read, but it's in the section of the Old Testament called the Writings. And in the Writings, there were five scrolls, five books: Song of Songs, Ruth, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, Esther. And what's interesting about these five scrolls, they were very significant to the Jewish population. Each of these scrolls would be read at various festivals, yearly festivals where the Jews would gather in their various communities, and they would open up, crack open the book of Ecclesiastes or Song of Songs or Esther, and they would be celebrating a particular festival of remembrance. Now, we'll come back to that later in the story. But this morning, what I want to do with you is I want to move through two chapters of Esther. We'll come back to some of the details next week. But the first two chapters, high level. The video was very, very high level. I'm still going to be high level, but a little bit lower than the highest level of what you just saw. I'm going to be right about here. We're not going to get into too many of the weeds because there's just a biblical narrative. There's lots of detail that we just can't cover in a morning in one sermon. But I want to take you through four scenes this morning. As we think about this idea, power is found in surprising places, has surprising faces. So you can see there is the image for the first scene. The first scene, if you open your Bible in Esther chapter 1, the first scene is from verse 1 to verse 8. I nailed it there. And the title that I would give, or there's the image that I think of when I think of scene number 1, and you'll see why in a minute. And this kind of dates me, but you know, Muhammad Ali, right? I am the greatest. I said that even before I knew I was. What a great line. And if I was to title this particular scene, this first scene, I would call this manpower. Because as we come to this scene and we think about power, there is nothing surprising about where we find power in this first scene. It's exactly where we would expect it. It's manpower, a king who believes he is the greatest. And there is power associated not just with the male gender, but with wealth and politics and military and a pedigree that this particular king has that gives him incredible power. This whole scene, this first scene, is all about the king telling people how great he is. And so with that understanding, we come to this, and let me read to you sections of the first scene. Now, in the days of Ahasuerus, and just so you know, there's like 1,000 different pronunciations, so I'm going with Ahasuerus. I thought I'd maybe just try Bob, but I realized that wouldn't work. So Ahasuerus, and the Ahasuerus, the king, who reigned from India to Ethiopia, he has a massive territory, over 127 provinces. In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, which was the capital of this Persian Empire, it was the third year of his reign, and notice, he gave a feast for all his officials and his servants. So notice there's a feast. That's one of the major themes of Esther. You know how many feasts there are in Esther? There's 10 of them. And there's four in the first four scenes that we'll see here this morning. And notice his name, Ahasuerus, his title. Guess what the name means? If you think about it, if this is manpower, guess what his name means? His name means either mighty one, no kidding, or mighty I. Secular historians tell us that in various cultures in that day, that they would have these feasts or these banquets, and sometimes the purpose of these feasts was to rally the troops, was to rally the empire together as they were about to embark on another battle to expand their territory. And so King Ahasuerus is gathering the troops, is gathering leaders to what? To showcase his power and to basically say, you can invite anybody into the ring, anybody that you want, and I will KO them because I am Ahasuerus. And so this whole feast is about declaring, I am the greatest. And so we continue to read in the year of his reign, verse 3, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants, the armies of Persia, Medai, and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him. While he showed, notice this, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days. And it says 180 days. It was all about the king. Can you imagine going to a party? And like within the first 10 minutes, you realize, oh, this party is all about the host. Make me sick. Right? This is the ultimate selfie. Look at me, right? And then in verse 5, and when these days were completed, as if 180 days were not enough, which would also include preparation for anticipated war, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. So now we're up to 187 days of a banquet, two feasts. Then notice the pomp, notice the riches, notice the wealth. This is not a cottage. Verse 6, there were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars, also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble and mother of pearl and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels. Vessels of different kinds and royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king, and drinking was according to his edict. There was no compulsion, for the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. Can you hear the crowds? Can you hear those that have gathered around the ring to watch this great Ahasuerus? Can you hear them chanting his name like perhaps they used to chant Ali, Ali, Ali? Now they're chanting Ahasuerus, Ahasuerus, Ahasuerus. You are the man. You are great. Scene one. Now, anything unusual about where power is found? The face in the place of power? No, I don't think so. Where's power? What gender? It's male in this context so far. It's political. It's military. It's ethnic. It's being the right ethnicity, which is to be Persian. And it's related to incredible wealth. The king is established. The master has been revealed. But then, verse 9, every king has a queen. Queen Vashti also gave a feast. Oh, there's the third feast. For the women in the palace, the king that belonged to King Ahasuerus. And so if scene one is manpower, scene number two, I call this woman power. And it reminds me of this image, Arab women rising, face of power, places of power that are unusual. This is Persian woman rising in this particular scene. And notice the contrast. You always want to notice that in a narrative. Now we come into this second scene, and there's the most bizarre. When I started to study this book, I thought, this is so bizarre. And then I thought, No, it's not, because I just have to watch the news and realize how bizarre the world is, and politics, and corporate news, and family news, personal, and your family, right? I mean, there's all kinds of wild stuff that happens. On the seventh day, scene two, when the heart of the king was merry, he was drunk, he was blitzed out of his brains, he commanded Mahuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, there we go. I stumbled on that in the first too. Zathar, Carcass, I think. The seven eunuchs, these guys that are castrated, who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to what? Show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. Wow. Just because it's in the Bible doesn't mean it's right. Okay? Just telling you here. There's just a, you need to know that. But Queen Vashti refused to come to the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. At this, the king became enraged and his anger burned within him. I just think there's a lot of humor in this. Most bizarre. First scene, look at me, how powerful I am. Second scene, look how powerless I am. First scene, I'm in control. I can knock out anybody that comes into the ring because I am Ahasuerus, but don't bring my wife because I can't seem to control her. And she can't seem to be corralled. She refuses to go in and display her beauty. Now, what is this? A striptease? A pole dance? I don't know. People read into this and they sexualize it, but there's nothing in this particular reference right here. Like, there's a lot of perverse sexuality going on, interaction here in these first four scenes, but there's nothing here to say that she was commanded to come in and strip, but that's sometimes how people interpret it. One author said maybe she's pregnant. Or maybe she's an introvert. You know, maybe the Frontenacs are playing and she wants to watch them play, lose another game. I don't know. But she did not come out. She did not want to come out into the crowds. But notice what we know about her. She was lovely. And I love the way that the writer puts it. She was lovely to look at. Well, there you go. Now, you need to notice something about Hebrew narrative. Whenever the narrator, the writer, says something about the physical features of a character, which is not very often, that means the writer wants you to note something. They want you to see something that's integral to the story, and so what does the writer want us to see? Now, we'll come back to that, but does he want us to see something more than beauty? Or does he just want us to see that she was a very beautiful woman? Notice here that there are eunuchs in this particular scene. These are the castrated employees of the king, and it was a well-known practice to castrate some of the men that would serve the king because it was thought that they would be less of a threat. And so while the eunuchs won't rival this king, Vashti does revile the king. You can see that in this particular scene. And so what does this great king do? He flexes his muscle, and he becomes, in some ways, a very small man, and he tries to deliver a knockout punch to his queen by using brute force and power, and the result is Vashti vanishes. And she's not even a major character in this drama called Esther. Ahasuerus is, but not Vashti. What happens is she disobeys the king's command that came through the eunuchs, and so there's this uprising. What will the Persian Empire think when his wife did not obey his command, and so we must take her off and get her off the scene? And so they dismiss her, she vanishes, and you'll see in verse 22, and again I'm highlighting this scene, he sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, that every man be master in his own household and speak according to the language of his people. She's gone. Now are you chanting Ahasuerus? Way to go. Are you impressed? How do you feel about the use of his power? Do you see any parallels to today? Does it display a man that is in control or paranoid of losing control? Does this display a man who has certainty or uncertainty? Does this just illustrate the cultural norms? Or is this trying to illustrate something else? Is the writer wanting us to see something about this king? This paranoid king? This insecure king? Perhaps? Not sure. What's interesting is this scene ends. And biblically, we would just jump into the next scene. But historians tell us that it's very likely that between scene 2 and scene 3, there are 4 years that pass. And before we come into scene 3, Ahasuerus wants to demonstrate the power of his kingdom. His father had lost to the Greeks, but the Persian Empire was expanding, and so he wanted to go and make up for the mess and the defeat. And he goes off and he tries to defeat the Greeks, but the Greeks beat him again. And so he comes back, and apparently perhaps 4 years later, and he's got these raccoon-like eyes because he's been beaten up. And so now he comes into scene number 3, and in the larger context, beaten up by Greece, beaten up by his wife, who won't submit to his will. And the eunuchs and some of his caretakers are feeling sorry for him. And so they say, well, let's make the king feel good. And we know that he needs to replace the queen. And so we come to scene 3. And I would entitle scene 3, 4 years after scene 2, as Woman Power Doubles Down. We have man power, scene 1. Scene 2 is woman power, scene 3. Woman power doubles down. And this is the image that I use. I didn't know who this woman was, but she's a pretty face. And let me tell you about Hedy Lamarr. Anybody ever heard of Hedy Lamarr? Okay, apparently I don't read enough. And interesting about Hedy, more than a pretty face, was considered one of the most beautiful women in Europe. Born in Vienna in 1914, by the 30s, she was a film star in the Europe and USA, but she didn't stop with movies, she became an inventor. Inspired to help the US effort in World War II, she worked to design radio guidance system for Allied troop torpedoes that would defeat the threat of jamming. Ultimately, her innovation was not used in the war, but the principles of her work are now incorporated into modern Wi-Fi, Bluetooth technology, and she was inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame in 2014. She's more than a pretty face. There's a lot of substance to this woman. Well, we come to scene number 3, and guess what? We come to a pretty face. Another pretty face. It's the bizarre nature of Esther, the book. It just tells it like it is. And so Vashti vanishes, but Esther now is going to enter. Unbeknownst to the king, unbeknownst to Vashti, and even unbeknownst to Esther, she is about to be given the leading role, and she never even signed up for this. We're not sure if she was forced into this role initially. We don't know. But here we have it. Verse 2 of scene 3, chapter 2. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's young men who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the capital under custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given them, and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. And this pleased the king, and he did so. It's got needs, right? Just because it's in the Bible doesn't make it right. So they collect all these young virgins, and they bring them. And if you read the larger context here, I'm not going to read all of this scene, but I mean, there's 12 months of preparation, cosmetic uplifts pedicures and manicures to get ready for the king, and you're trying out. And we now read verse 5. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai. Ah, here's our second major character, the son of Jair, son of Shammai, son of Kish, a Benjamite. So it gives us the kind of the genealogy of this guy who had been carried away from Jerusalem. So now here's some history. Why were there Jews in Persia? Well, they were carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom, and here's a famous name, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. So there's some historical context here. And then verse 7, he was bringing up Hadassah, that is the Hebrew name, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother, so Mordecai and Esther, cousins. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. What do you note? Huh, interesting. They just mentioned Vashti was a beautiful woman, lovely to look at. Now, Esther, there's a lot of beautiful people in this first four scenes. A lot of beautiful people. And the question is, why is that physical beauty being mentioned? Again, remember, it's unusual for a biblical narrator in the Old Testament Hebrew to bring attention to the physical appearance of a particular character. What does he want us to see? Is it perhaps that Vashti, while being beautiful, there was something to her character because she stood up to the most powerful man in the world? Maybe there's more than just beauty here. Maybe there's something below the surface. And for Esther, well, we don't know Esther yet. Well, maybe you do because you've read the book. But if you've never read the book before, it's like, wow, she's beautiful, but I wonder if there's any substance to her. Is there anything to her at all beyond her face? Is there something we're supposed to be looking for? Or perhaps the narrator just tells us that these are beautiful women because this is the appetite of the king. He has a thing for beautiful women. Well, the story proceeds, the scene unfolds. We won't read all those details, but Miss Universe contest, you know, beauty pageant happens. There's all kinds of objectification here going on, and there's all kinds of parallels to modern culture. But guess who wins the beauty pageant? Right, Esther. And it says in verse 18, then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. Wow. And he also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. What do you notice here? The king, Esther has what? Influence. She has influence. She has, if maybe it's overstating it here, but she has a degree of power over the most powerful man in the world. So much influence that he names a banquet after her. So much influence that he remits taxes. So much he backs off on taxes. So much influence that he gives out gifts like royal generosity, it says. Now, remember that statement? Power is found in surprising places and has surprising faces at times. What's most surprising about this? Some people might say, well, maybe most surprising is that she's a woman in a male-dominated world. Well, and she has this kind of influence. Well, maybe not, but maybe, because the king wanted to shut her down because every man should rule his house. That's what he said. So maybe that's a bit of the surprise. But there were women who were military leaders in that era. So maybe that's not the surprise. Maybe the biggest surprise about the face of power or influence and the place, maybe the biggest surprise is that what the author tells us, not only in scene 3, but he tells us again in scene 4. He tells us something about Esther that maybe is the biggest surprise of all. And that is what? That she is a Jew. Right, you've read the story. She's a Jew. A Jew is in the courts and has the Gentile king's heart. And what is so fascinating is it is a secret. And so what is going on here? Is there something going on beyond the face of this story, beyond the surface? One writer said this in a completely different book that I was reading, said, the leaf, when perceived, might blind the observer to the tree. The leaf, when perceived, might blind the observer to the tree. And the tree, when perceived, might blind the observer to the forest. I mean, ask a Jew, what's happening in the story? And I think a Jew, because remember, they would celebrate a festival and they would read Esther and they would know the story from beginning to end. A Jew would be able to tell you there is more here than just a pretty face. A Jew would be able to tell you, look beyond the leaf, look beyond the tree, see the forest, See what God is up to as he moves his people into place. And with that, we come to the final scene. In the final scene, I would entitle Secrets. And we won't read this final scene, because I'm running out of time. But I'll summarize it for you. In this final scene, there are two secrets. The secret that's already been revealed in scene 3 is re-emphasized in scene 4, and whenever a narrator emphasizes, repeats something, it's important to the narrative. He's telling us again, she's Jewish. Mordecai is Jewish, and they know that, but they don't necessarily know the connection between Mordecai and Esther. Esther's a Jew. And that is a secret that is powerful when you understand the story, because the story is that God will use Esther, a Jew, to save her people, Jews, from an attempted genocide by the fourth main character of this story, which we'll meet either next week or the week after. There's power in that secret. There's significance in why there's a Jew cuddling up to a Gentile king, as messy as that looks, and it is messy. It's a powerful secret. Because really there's another king, right, in the room. And there's another secret. A secret that Mordecai and Esther were revealed to them, that there were two eunuchs who aren't supposed to rival the king, but they do, and they want to overthrow him, and they find out about this coup attempt, and they tell the king, and they save his life. And it says at the end of that scene that that was recorded in the chronicles, a record of history. And what's fascinating is later on, I think it's in chapter 6, the king reads the chronicle and is reminded that, wow, Mordecai and Esther did me such a great favor, and Mordecai gets a promotion. And that secret, that knowledge that they have is key to promotion, is key to influence, is key to power. Two very interesting secrets. So who's really in charge? What does power look like? Now you see me, now you don't. Is God visible in these first two chapters? As we heard, his name is never mentioned. The name of God is never mentioned in Esther. The king, the word king, 100 times. The name of the king, 30 times. God's name, 0 times. But ask a Jew, what's going on? And they could tell you. A Jew would read this story or hear it read and know how it all ends. And they would see how God was putting in place his people to accomplish his work, which is the story of Esther. The story of Esther is about the providence and the sovereignty of God. And it's not loud. It's not loud in this book. It's not obvious necessarily. Like the beauty of Vashti and Esther that demonstrates there is more going on below the surface than we can see. There's more than a pretty face. This story invites us to look beyond the face of this story, to look beyond the surface, to look beyond the leaf, beyond the tree, and to see the forest, to see what God is doing. And guess what? It's not all pretty. It's not all ordered. It's not all godly. It's not all neat. It's not all tidy. There are a lot of questions that come up as we see Esther engaging in what she engages in. It's messy. Power is found in surprising places and has surprising faces at times, because the king is in the ring, and the greatest king who moves pieces into place to accomplish what he wants, and sometimes he uses faces and shows up in places that are very, very surprising. So what does all this have to do with us this morning? So what? So what? Well, let me give you three quick takeaways. So I read this story, thinking of it as a disciple, as a Christ follower. I think there's a great question to ask. I walk away from this story and I go, the great question to ask as a Christ follower is this: what is God up to? Because you remember, Jews would read this scroll yearly. They would read the book of Esther. And it would remind them that God is up to something, even when you can't see his name, even though you can't hear his name, even though it may not be obvious, God is in control, and that we're not a bunch of random atoms bouncing off the wall, hoping things land in our favor, but not quite sure. No, this story reminds us that God is at work. And when I ask the question, what is God up to coming out of Esther? It's not a question of doubt. It is a question of expectation. What is God up to in this world? What is God up to in my life? I may not understand it, but I understand the sovereignty of God, and Esther is about the sovereignty of God, and that he's orchestrating. I mean, ever found yourself in those situations asking, what is God up to? We've all been there. Some of us may be there right now. What is God up to? And you might not be as polite as I just was when you asked God that question. You might insert a few other words. What are you up to? I don't see your name. I don't hear your voice. I don't see results. The face of so-called power, the place of so-called power, doesn't really fit with my paradigm. What is God up to? Esther gives us hope that God is up to something because he's sovereign. It may not land like we want it to land. That's not what Esther's about. It's not saying, well, it'll all work out. No, not necessarily. But it'll all work out in God's eyes, but we can trust a God that knows how it will work out. So that's a great question. What is God up to? Then there's a best practice. Third takeaway. And I think a best practice is this. Pray without ceasing. This next picture is a picture of a group that myself and my wife and Jamie, we lead. It's called Battle Plan. It's one of our core groups. It's on prayer. And in that group, we talk about pray without ceasing. And as I was sitting in the class one Thursday night a couple weeks ago, I thought, yeah, you know, if God is sovereign, then it makes all kinds of sense that if God is active and God is working, and even though I can't always hear his name, it makes a lot of sense that I would pray and that I would pray without ceasing. Because I can't always see and I can't always figure it out, but I know the one who does. And so prayer connects me to the one who is connected and sees all things. And so I want to pray. I want to be connected and just trust the one who sees it all. I like what one person defines sovereignty as. He says this, God's attention concentrated everywhere. God's attention concentrated everywhere. Well, guess what? I can't have my attention concentrated everywhere. You can't either. And if you do, you'll fail. You have to have a nice little focus. But God's attention is concentrated everywhere. Seems to even contradict concentration. But we're talking about God. His attention is concentrated everywhere. And prayer focuses my attention on God, whose attention is concentrated everywhere. That's crazy. And there are times in life, right, where you walk through life and you don't know, and it's like you're blindfolded and you're holding the hand of Jesus and you're going through a season and you say, I can't see how this makes sense. I see no work of God in this situation and I hear no name of God, but I'm praying and I'm praying without ceasing and I'm staying connected to the heart of God because his attention is concentrated everywhere, so I'm going to give him my attention through prayer. And I'm going to pray without ceasing. And some of us are probably in a season right now where I'm praying without ceasing because I'm so desperate in a situation for my kid, for my wife, for my uncle, for my job, for my health, that I just got to keep, I pray, and I pray, and I pray. I think there's a best practice here. And then finally, there's a question, there's a practice, and then there's the best deliverer, right? Esther is a type of deliverer. Moses was a type of, to illustrate the ultimate. And so you see some of the parallels and contrast. A Jewish woman in the powerful courts of the Gentiles seems least likely to succeed. A Jewish man in the powerful courts of the Gentiles at the time, Rome, seemed least likely to succeed, right? A Jewish woman in the house of the king, where man ruled, seemed most vulnerable and objectified. A Jewish man under the thumb of Caesar seemed most vulnerable. A king has a banquet. A king in the first scene has a banquet that says, look how great I am, serve my interests. But another king 2,000 years later has a banquet to serve others. And he washes the feet of the disciples and they're just freaking out because this is not how they understand the face of power. And they're shocked. A Jewish woman deliverer, Esther, is described as what? Beautiful. Lovely to look at. And the deliverer, 2,000 years later, approximately, what was it said about him? He had no beauty that we should even desire him. Power is found in surprising places and has surprising faces at times. And whether it's found in the book of Esther or on a cross, the greatest work of all time was done right under the noses of the most powerful kingdom, Rome, and it did not look like anything they would associate with power. Unusual place, unusual face. But as we understand sovereignty and how God works, guess what? He shows up in unusual places, and he has unusual faces. But they are reminders that even though the name may not be mentioned, God is present and God is working. That's the big idea, really, of Esther. Let's pray. And as we just take a moment to respond here, I don't know where you're at. I don't know how your week has gone. I don't know how your life is unfolding these days. But perhaps in prayer this morning, you think of your situation and you say, Lord, help me to ask that question, what are you up to, from a posture of expectation with the desire to be aligned. God, I look at my world, it's messy, it's jaded, it's not what I wanted, it's not what I expected, it's not what I even like, it's the last place I want to be for me where I am or where the loved ones I have in my life are. But Lord, I want to ask that question with a sense of optimism. What are you up to? How can I be aligned with your purposes in this particular situation? Maybe that's your prayer. Lord, help me to ask that question, what are you up to, with a sense of optimism and hope. Or perhaps as you think about this issue of prayer, it's, Lord, I'm in a dark room, or it's a valley, it's a challenge, it's the last place I want to be. Get me out of here. But if you're not going to get me out of here, help me to pray. Help me to pray. And to keep my attention on the one whose attention is concentrated everywhere. Help me to pray, God. Maybe that's some of us this morning. We pray, oh God, help me to pray. Help me just stay connected. Because I can't see the way right now. And for the best deliverer, perhaps you're here this morning, you've never accepted Christ, and perhaps you say, Lord Jesus, be my deliverer from my sin, my brokenness. Or perhaps as a Christ follower, you were saying, Lord, I need you to be my deliverer. You delivered me from sin when I came to faith. Now deliver me as I walk out that faith. Deliver me through this season. I choose to follow you. I choose to keep my eyes on you. I choose to understand that one of your names is Redeemer, Deliverer, Emmanuel, that God that is with me in this challenge season. Lord, we thank you for this story this morning. We thank you for the mystery of it. We thank you for the tension. We thank you for the theology. We thank you for where it's placed in our scripture. We thank you that it has brought hope to thousands and thousands of people across the span of time, and how it's brought hope to a Jewish nation who needed to read this during times of genocide, during times of persecution. Keep our eyes on you, Lord, in these days, we pray. Let's stand as we sing.